You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Associate Professor of Sociology and Global Studies at the University of Minnesota, Rachel Sherman. She earned her PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and has taught at UC Berkeley and also at the University of Illinois. In the 1980s, she worked at Food First in San Francisco with Frances Moore LePay. She is the co-editor of Engineering Trouble, Biotechnology and Its Discontents, and is here today to talk about her new book published by the University of Minnesota Press entitled Fighting for the Future of Food. We're very pleased to have her with us. Please join me in welcoming Rachel Sherman.
Thank you, and thanks for coming on this nice one of the last fall days that we'll probably get to enjoy. I should probably tell you a little bit about how I got interested in this topic. The subject of this book is really the 30-year-long controversy around genetic engineering, and I got interested in it in the late 1990s when I was living in Illinois, and I was editing this other book, actually, that includes work by a bunch of my students, PhD students at Berkeley, where I had taught before Illinois. And all of them were studying industries that were starting to be affected by the biotechnology developments. And so we were putting together that book, and there was a piece of it. It's an edited volume, and I kept noticing how much struggle was going around on this technology, and I decided to start studying it to write just a short chapter for that edited volume, and I got totally sucked in. What was happening around that time in Illinois was the newspapers were carrying all these articles about what was going on in the farm sector. Farmers were bringing their corn to the elevators, and from one day to the next, the elevators started refusing their corn. And of course, the farmers had spent an entire season growing GM corn. It was not any problem in the United States. And all of a sudden, they were losing their market. And being in Illinois, which is a corn and soy state, was a great place to start this book because I was in the middle of all the genetically engineered corn and soy around. But anyway, they were flipping out because they were unable to sell their product to the elevators. The elevators were flipping out because they had lost their markets to Europe. The whole agricultural industry in the U.S. was shaken up by this event, and they pulled in the Office of the Trade Representative, which at the time was Mickey Cantor, who was working for Clinton, and he went to Europe and tried to negotiate that Europe would allow these crops in, and the Europeans basically said, we can't, there's too much popular protest. And so they didn't for a while. That whole event kind of blew over, and farmers had found other markets for their products. They continued to grow a lot of GM corn and soy, but they stopped shipping the GM corn and soy to Europe. So I got interested in what seemed to be a fairly small group of activists who had stopped international trade. And not only had they stopped, this ongoing trade with Europe around U.S. corn, but also the industry started, it looked like it was falling apart before my eyes. This was between 1999 and 2001, and all these big companies that had invested in trying to build up a life sciences platform and were bringing together pharmaceutical companies with agricultural companies, with even oil companies were involved in this. They started selling off their agricultural divisions. In fact, Farmacia had bought Monsanto in the mid-1990s and then turned around and just sold off the agricultural division in, I think it was like 2000 or 2000, maybe it was 1999. In any event, so the industry was starting to restructure itself and starting to shed the agricultural part of its businesses. And it turned out that this was because the industry was in so much trouble. A lot of these companies had invested very heavily in developing genetically modified plants and seeds and taken out a lot of patents. And they had bought up a lot of seed companies, and they were in a lot of debt. And they were causing a net outflow of capital, not a net inflow of capital for these big life sciences firms. So I just got fascinated by the fact that what looked like a very small number of people could have such a huge effect. And being interested in social movements, I ended up studying this one. So let's see. So basically, that was one of my most important, kind of central questions was, how did this small group of activists trip up this industry? And then I got interested in the question of who were these activists and what was the big deal? What were they so anxious about? What was it that made them get up in the morning and say to themselves, I'm not going to go, to a regular job. I'm going to get up and fight biotechnology all day long for the next 15 or 20 years. And it turned out that some of the people I interviewed in the sector had been involved in this struggle for 20 years, 25 years. I mean, that's an amazing amount of time to get up every day and work on the same issue. It becomes like a lifelong job. And that's not all they do, and many of them have been involved in, they work in organizations typically, activist organizations that work on a number of issues, but there's some people who've just worked on this one. And so I got really interested in what would motivate them to do that. So I started studying these two questions and got really interested in the history of this movement. First, I thought it was just European activists that were up in arms, but once I started digging in, I very quickly figured out that the movement had actually started here in the U.S., in Cambridge, Massachusetts, interestingly enough. And then some of those ideas had made their way to Europe. There were Europeans who were starting to become concerned in the 1970s, as soon as the technologies started being developed, and this is way before genetic engineering technologies were actually deployed commercially. But just when they were developed, certain people started getting very concerned about them and organizing around them and working on them. So I started interviewing those people. And this book is based on about 80 interviews, in-depth, long interviews with activists and also people in the industry and others, as well as lots of other kinds of data. And I decided pretty early on, I actually wrote this book with a colleague from Illinois, and we decided early on that we needed to understand both the activists and the industry, that there was no way to understand the struggle if we just studied the activists. So we did both and learned a lot from doing these interviews. So essentially what we did was we kind of dug into the history of this movement and tried to understand what the sensibilities were that kind of triggered this response to biotechnology. And then we also kind of tried to study the industry and kind of the way in which it understood the world. And we ended up coming up with a kind of a concept that we used to understand this struggle, which we've called life worlds. And we understand this kind of fight between the activists and the industry as really an issue of very different understandings of the world and assumptions and values and ways of looking at the world, and that these two worlds came into conflict and have remained that way for 30 years. So why don't I take you a little bit into these life worlds, and I'll read a little bit from this book about kind of the way in which different groups saw this technology. And what we ultimately do with this concept of life worlds is use it to explain both the way in which these two groups thought about what they were doing and also why it was that the activists were able to wreak such damage to the industry. It certainly hasn't stopped genetically engineered crops from being developed and deployed, but it's had a really big effect on the way in which those crops are received, the way in which Europeans have stopped them from coming into their country, to their continent by and large, and also those effects have reverberated around the world. Other people in other countries have been very concerned as well, partly because they're afraid of losing markets, partly because they're worried about the environmental problems that might be associated with these novel plants. So anyway, I thought I'd give you an opportunity to hear some of the voices of the people I spoke with. And to do this, I have to switch glasses because I can't see it anymore. So anyway, what I'm going to start with is just a little segment from the historical part of our analysis. I'm going to read bits from quotes with the industry and bits from quotes with the activists, but I'll start with the critics of the technology and tell you what they were concerned about, because I think they get the activists around this get a lot of bad press, partly because they're seen to be neo-Luddites and kind of reactionary and rejecting of science and technology. And I hope you can walk away with the idea that it's much more complicated than that. And this technology kind of hits on different sensibilities than just, you know, than those. So some of the first people to question the wisdom of genetic engineering were those who were closest to it, namely scientists based in the biological sciences. In fact, shortly after our DNA, recombinant DNA, was discovered, a Cold Spring Harbor virologist by the name of Robert Pollack raised the specter of novel pathogens arising out of the use of these new gene splicing technologies, and several prominent scientists published a letter of warning about their potential hazards in Science magazine in 1974. And right after this, actually, in 1975, there was a large meeting of scientists in Asilomar, California, to talk about what the possible threats and risks of rDNA technology were. So at that time, the whole scientific community in the U.S. Had some apprehension. I wouldn't say the whole, but there were many people who had a lot of apprehensions about this. And they met in Asilomar, California, talked about it, and over time, most people became less and less worried about what these risks were. But that wasn't true of everybody. While most of the scientists who participated in these rDNA debates, as they were called, soon abandoned their worries about gene splicing, a few remained deeply concerned about the technology's safety, as well as its potential societal impacts. Among them were Dr. George Wald and Dr. Ruth Hubbard, professors of biology at Harvard University, Dr. Erwin Chargaff, professor emeritus of biochemistry at Columbia, Jonathan King, professor of biology at MIT, Lieb Cavalieri, professor of biochemistry at the Grad School of Medicine at Cornell, and Sloan Kettering Institute for Cancer Research, and Dr. Stuart Newman, an assistant professor of biology at the State University of New York, Albany. And a lot of these, or a number of these folks, had been associated with a group called Science for the People, which some of you may have heard of. It was a group of kind of left-leaning scientists who had gotten together in Cambridge in the 60s. Many of them were involved in the anti-war effort, and they were quite concerned about the role that science could play in society. You know, they were scientists themselves, and they had become quite sensitive to the fact that science could be used in both positive and negative ways for society. And they were involved in this small group that tried to address those issues. And a splinter group was formed from Science for the People, and it was called the Council for Responsible Genetics. And they were some of the first people who were kind of working on this issue and trying to organize around it. And they actually tried to stop Harvard from building a laboratory where they would start doing rDNA experiments. And let me just read you a couple of the quotes from some of these folks, so because I think they really clearly express their concerns. So when these scientists saw their universities rushing to build rDNA lab facilities and their colleagues getting involved in new business ventures based on genetic engineering research, they questioned the forces that were underlying these developments. And one of the interesting things that was happening in the 70s was not only that scientists were starting to do some of this research, but all of a sudden these folks were becoming entrepreneurs and starting their own businesses on the side. And so some of their colleagues, you know, those in the very same departments, were looking at these same technologies and saying, wait a minute, you know, something doesn't smell very good around here. We're both concerned about what's going to happen with the technologies and the fact that a number of, you know, really well-known scientists or well-respected scientists are now becoming businessmen in this area. You know, what kinds of incentives are they responding to, and, you know, what's going on here? So these scientists asked whether enough was known about the risks and dangers of these technologies to plunge so blithely ahead. As biologist Lieb Cavalieri noted in a New York Times magazine in 1976, Most problems of modern technology build up visually and visibly and gradually and can be stopped before a critical stage is reached. Not so with genetically altered bacteria. A single unrecognized accident could contaminate the entire Earth, he wrote, with an ineradicable and dangerous agent that might not reveal its presence until its deadly work was done. MIT biologist Jonathan King spoke even more bluntly about the dangerous role science could play in society if it was not subjected to critical examination. Doing science for the sake of science could generate enormous risks, in his view, risks that were often downplayed by those who had personal or political interests in that type of scientific research. I was a grad student at Caltech during the Vietnam War years, where there were a lot of missile engineers, noted King, at a National Academy of Sciences forum on research involving recombinant DNA. And this is a long quote I'm going to read from him. It's a little dense. A number of us were concerned that these people were using their scientific skills to design devices to kill people. And we would raise questions sitting in our dormitories, and they would say, "You're interfering with our freedom of inquiry." "What freedom of inquiry? You're making missiles." They would say, "We're not making missiles. We are studying the motion of an elongated projectile through a liquid medium, and if we cannot do that, we cannot learn about it." We're being told that we don't want to have this experiment done, modifying living organisms to have it prove to us that it's not a disaster, we're holding back knowledge. Now I ask you, what's going to happen if by some small chance the Walds and the Hubbards and the Chargaffs and the Cavalieris are right? What if the experiment is done and we get the answer, it's a disaster, where will we be? So that was the kind of thing that was motivating that group. Okay, let me switch to the industry for a minute. I've sort of done this in the wrong order. I should have kept these separate because I'm going to go back to the activists in a few minutes. But one of the things I studied was kind of, as I said, the world of the industry. And there are really two different groups of actors here. One were the scientists who were drawn into industry, who either started their own companies, but more often were brought into large ag biotech companies or companies that were going in the direction like Monsanto, DuPont, Novartis, and others. And they were basically having the time of their lives coming out of academia and going into a situation where there was a lot of money being thrown at them. They had a lot of freedom, and it was really exciting. And I guess one of the things I took away from those interviews was kind of that intense feeling of excitement of being at the beginning of a new scientific development and having all these resources with which they could go about doing their work. And, you know, most of these folks had come out of academia where the incentive systems are very different and the bureaucratic structure is different. And one fellow who teaches at Washington University for a number of years, he was at DuPont, and he said, "There was nothing like this." You know, basically, well, actually, I have a quote from him I could read. He said, "It was like heaven, no budgets, whatever you wanted to do," with more than a hint of nostalgia in his voice. "I had probably the greatest group of PIs, principal investigators, I could ever imagine. They were doing basic research. I did some of my best work in those 2 or 3 years with a few postdocs. There was a science paper and a nature paper," and any of you who are scientists know that that is a coup to publish in those highly regarded journals. "I never had that happen in academia," he said. And to top it off, at least during the early years, there was no pressure for product development because they were, you know, these companies, many of them were pharmaceutical companies and chemical companies, and they knew that their investments were not going to turn over in a year. They expected to have 10-year time frames. So there wasn't a lot of pressure on those scientists to come up immediately with something, although relatively soon after there was. Basically, it was very hard to overestimate the degree of excitement they felt as they forged this new world of genetic engineering. The scientists at this time shared a powerful sense, and this was one that was picked up by the media, that this was a technology with virtually endless possibilities. According to the discourse of the day, genetic engineering could permit fish to survive in freezing cold waters, produce vine-ripened tomatoes that would not bruise on their way to market, and yield more nutritional crops. The words of Mary Dell Chilton, one of the pioneers of this new technology, reflected this widely shared optimism. "The solutions are coming very fast now," proclaimed Chilton, not long after biotech's birth. "In 3 years, we'll be able to do anything with gene manipulations that our imaginations will get us to." And one of the people I got to interview for this study was the ex-CEO of Monsanto in like the late 70s, early 1980s. His name was Jack Hanley. And he was telling me these stories of just how exciting this was and how these possibilities did in fact seem endless. And he recalled being in a meeting with a bunch of scientists, and they were talking about being able to produce 50-pound turkeys through genetic engineering. And he said, "I don't know what they were talking about, but basically it was, you know, it was a very kind of exciting and exciting moment." And so, as I said before, there were two groups in industry that were really important here. One were these scientists who were, you know, going great guns because they were given all these resources and they were wanted to be at the head of the discoveries, and the companies were competing with each other. And the other one were the corporate managers in those firms who were really kind of caught this infectious enthusiasm of the scientists and really wanted to go to town with this. And a company like Monsanto actually put all of its eggs in this basket and started shedding its other enterprises as time went on, because it saw this as the wave of the future. In fact, all these companies felt like they had to get on this train or they were going to be knocked off because biotechnology was becoming such an important player. So I just want to give you a little bit of a sense of not only were these scientists excited by the possibilities, but one of the things that I think really motivated them was the sense that they were doing well by doing good. They were being very well paid. They were, you know, conditions were very good for them in the industry. But at the same time, many of them felt like they were doing something good for the world. And I think that's part of this clash of life worlds that I encountered, was these scientists thought, We're gonna do things that are good for the environment. We're gonna create plants that don't need pesticides and so on. And you know, why on earth would anybody be opposed to this? So this is sort of the way they saw this issue, in part because they'd been trained in the techniques, and in part because they felt confident in their own knowledge of the science. The vast majority of industry scientists believed these techniques were safe for humans and the environment. This belief only grew stronger as time went on, and those working with our DNA techniques became even more certain about the soundness of their science. This is the same stuff we've been doing for years. It's just more efficient. It's just better. It's inherently safer, at least from all we know of the science after the last 15 years, noted an expert in plant viruses. I can't tell you who that is, but he's in a very powerful position today in the U.S. government. Most scientists readily admitted that some risks were involved, but they gauged those risks to be small. Furthermore, they've figured that all technologies carried risks, and that was just the nature of technology. So the question is, what risks are we talking about? Queried a biochemist who'd worked in the industry for many years. And this is what he said. "Is there a risk of human safety? I mean, to the extent that we've studied it, there's nothing we can uncover that says that we have risk. So at that point, you have to say, you know what? I can't find any risk here. So yeah, it's risk-free. But then, is it possible that tomorrow somebody might have a new tool and a new way of looking at it? It's possible, but not probable. So if anyone says to you something's totally risk-free, then they're inhaling stuff. There's no such thing as risk-free." Okay, so that is sort of the sense there. And in terms of this doing well by doing good, I want to read you just a couple of quotes to indicate how people understood their own labor in these firms. And their own science. "We believed in it," explained an entomologist who was motivated to work in the industry by her desire to bring non-chemical pest control solutions to the market. "We were trying to get away from the toxic legacy. I mean, if you have 15 sprays of nasty chemicals on cotton, or you're putting a BT gene in, BT being very safe, then it's a no-brainer." According to this scientist, many of her colleagues were caught off guard by the social opposition to genetic engineering, precisely because they thought they were doing something beneficial for the environment. And this is what she said. "The scientists, well, the senior managers all the way down to the scientists, all had a very, very strong belief that we were doing something good for the world. And it was quite surprising for Monsanto, that's where she worked, that it would be seen as the opposite of that, because everybody thought, here, we're taking chemicals off the market and greening up the world with a new technology. So they were, you know, folks like that were just couldn't understand what on earth, you know, the activists could see as being problematic with this technology. And over time, they really came to dismiss the activist concerns and to see them as crazy. Not so much the scientists, but a lot of people in their kind of corporate managers described the environmental the activists to me as like environmental crazies. And basically, they just could not at all understand what the issue was for these folks. Here's one way of looking at it. Ours is a very rational culture, explained a former Monsanto scientist as he sought to make sense of what his opponents were thinking. Well, the industry scientists, we process everything through the lens of, all right, what are the facts? Not what are the emotions, but what are the facts? So it's that cultural lens of trying to look at the world in such a rational, organized, systematic fashion, and then process everything methodically and figure out the solution, which is what industry tries to do. But to make the connection the way the activists come at it, so cloning is bad, they say. Why is cloning bad, I ask them. Cloning's bad because my religious leader said it's so. Why did the religious leader say so? I don't know. You go talk to him or her. God told me in my dreams that I should say so. How do you process that? Now, of course, nobody has ever said that to this guy, but that's how he understood it, right? That these were people who were motivated by craziness. Okay, so that was the industry's world. And then you bring the scientists together with the corporate managers, and for them, the idea was we want to develop seeds and crops and whatnot that can make us money, that can show that that our company's growing and has high growth potential, and that we plan to take out patents on. And so for the industry, taking out patents became totally normalized. It was part of their life world. And I was really interested in that because actually that's what got the activist goat, maybe more than anything else, was that the industry was patenting life. And there were another set of legal and institutional changes that took place during this time, which augmented firms' abilities to take out patents on genes, gene sequences, and the tools that they use to genetically modify crops. So that was the industry's life world, and they were kind of marching along as fast as possible, actually running along, trying to outcompete each other. They were focused not only on other companies and the competition among them, but they were really focused on their main customers, who were American farmers. And they didn't really, you know, the activists were a bit of a pest on the side, but they never suspected that these activists could stop international trade or wreak such havoc on their plans. So now I'm going to switch and bring you over into the activist life world for a minute. So I told you a little bit about kind of where some of these folks came from. That was the very beginning of the movement. But after that, it grew to encompass people with a lot of broader concerns, people who are concerned with development and what this was going to mean for what was then called the Third World and is now called the Global South. They were worried about seeds being patented and what that would mean for farmers in the Global South who now would have to go to the market and pay Monsanto or Syngenta or DuPont for their seeds and not be able to save seeds. I mean, some of these concerns were reasonable and some were probably overblown, but that's what motivated. So there were two sets of concerns. And then there were folks who were concerned about the environment and letting this stuff loose in the environment. And I'll just read some quotes to you. But one of the differences between industry and the activists, I think, was really central, was industry thought about these technologies very much outside of their political economic context. They thought of them in terms of what they could do for the firm and what they could do to, you know, maybe improve conditions and make life easier for farmers and maybe solve some environmental problems. But the activists saw them very much located in a political economy and were very suspicious about what these technologies would bring and we looked at the histories of these people, it was really interesting. These were not a bunch of 22-year-old green-haired anarchists. Most of the people in this movement were between 40 and 60 years old. You know, they'd lived through the war years, they'd been the Vietnam War years. They were radicalized by either the civil rights movement, the women's combination, civil rights movement, women's movement, environmental movement, anti-Vietnam War movement. And they were really suspicious of corporations and also were not particularly trusting of government regulators, who they saw as being much more on the side of industry. And many of them were motivated, you know, by these concerns. They were all really motivated by these concerns. So I'll just read a few quotes and then I'll stop for questions because I know this is a lot. Like the industry scientists and business people that I've just described, most of the activists who began organizing around biotech came to the issue with a particular worldview. From within this worldview, certain ideas held by scientists, industry, governments, and universities and their accompanying behaviors were deemed acceptable and right by these individuals, while other ideas and behaviors were seen to be unacceptable and in some cases totally egregious. In fact, it was the normative elements of people's worldviews, which were inextricably linked to their values, that motivated them to take action. And if we look at these moral sensibilities, we can better understand why they stuck with this, got involved in this movement and then stuck with it for so long. So many of those who looked on the new scientific industrial developments with foreboding rejected the predominant values of contemporary capitalist society, and they embraced alternative value schemes and moral codes. These alternative schemes rejected mainstream society's utilitarian views of nature, and they consciously placed the well-being of society and the environment ahead of the profitability of corporations. A major outrage for many derived from the perception that corporations had come to wield an unprecedented and dangerous degree of power in the world, which they readily and quite typically abused. And one activist said, this person had been working on the issue for several decades, and she said, "We don't have a blanket opposition to GMOs. Really, it's a matter of ownership and control, and that's why we've always focused on these issues, because it's just so clear to me. When you look at what's really happened in the 130 million acres that have been planted, and the fact that Monsanto's technology accounts for 91% of that worldwide, what else do you need to know? We're talking about control by a single company. There aren't five gene giants, there's really only one," she said. And another activist who was in her mid-50s at the time observed, "Biotechnology comes on the scene when corporations have too much power in the world. Especially in the global environment where there aren't, in fact, any governance structures, it's especially dangerous because it's going to be driven with greed and opportunity." Another person I interviewed, who was also a scientist working at a large activist scientist group, said, "I've had cancer. I think that the pesticide companies, like the tobacco companies, have been lying for years about the dangers of pesticides. And the fact is that they've gotten away for years with promoting these pesticides and denying their risks. And now they're admitting the risks of these pesticides and saying, well, instead of those, buy biotechnology. You know, these are the same companies." So many of these folks were distressed by and very indignant by the lack of democratic input into these technologies, feeling like the companies had just developed this technology and were going to bring it into society with no public discussion. One said, "Here you're unleashing a science and a technology that we have no idea what it means for the long-term evolution of the ecology." She wasn't particularly articulate. She meant the environment, I think. "And it just dumbfounded me. I mean, it really did stop me on a gut level, and I said, this is wrong. We need moral debate. We need public debate. We need scientific debate. We're completely eliminating a democratic process for discussing this technology." So those were some of the feelings that the activists brought to the movement and kind of what kept them involved for so many years. And so that's kind of a big chunk of what this book is about, trying to get into these worlds. And another piece of it is really about how these life worlds of the industry and the activists made it possible for the activists to kind of trip up the industry, because those the life world of the industry created certain blind spots for it and led it to engage in particular behaviors that actually backfired. They were pretty counterproductive. Like when Monsanto decided to go into Europe, it was told by a European company that had actually introduced a genetically engineered product into the market before Monsanto did. The CEO of that corporation had flown to St. Louis, sat down with Bob Shapiro, who was head of Monsanto at the time, and said, look, if you want to bring this technology in, make sure you label it and talk about it as something positive. Don't try to slip it in the back door. And Shapiro decided not to listen to him, and he basically sent his crops to Europe unlabeled and unidentified. And when the activists got wind of that, they were able to make a really big deal of it and say that, you know, Monsanto was trying to slip something over on the Europeans. And so these companies, but particularly Monsanto, made a lot of strategic errors. And those strategic errors, I think, are what gave the activists certain foothold and made it possible for them to affect the industry in some pretty significant ways. So anyway, I'll stop there. I'm happy to talk about this. Another thing we discuss in the book is why Europe reacted so differently than the United States, why the activists were successful in Europe but not in the United States. If people are interested in talking about that or any of these issues. So I'll stop now. Yeah.
Do you want to reveal kind of where you ended up standing? I mean, do you see that there's a place for GMO, yet modification? I mean, in an ideal world, knowing what you know, what would the structure look like?
My feeling is that I don't know enough about the science, frankly, to take a strong position on it. What I've tried to do is talk to scientists who don't have an economic investment in the industry and listen to what they think. I guess my concerns would be, what is it being used for, who's promoting it, and under what conditions? And that's actually the concerns of some of the activists that I've interviewed. I don't think that some of the folks who have fought against it so hard would be as opposed to it if there were not patents involved and it were not being rushed through without a sense that the U.S. government and other governments were seriously and independently doing tests on it. I think a lot of the concern comes from the way in which it was introduced and the efforts that the industry made, and it made a lot of them, to shape the regulation of it and to have a lot of influence over regulators. So those to me are very legitimate concerns. I don't take a strong position, yes or no. I think the real question is, who's promoting it and for what purpose? And interestingly, I think one of the most interesting things that's kind of happened as a result of this is that other actors have had to get involved, because basically the industry and the activists were at such loggerheads, and the activists have actually been able to stop some of the technologies from being developed. And what they've done is they've pointed to the industry and they say, you're only producing for first world farmers. These are only the only crops that you've really invested in are ones that can be grown on, you know, 10,000 acre, 4,000 acre U.S. farms. If you really care about world hunger, which is what you say you care about, why aren't you investing in sorghum? And of course, the companies aren't going to invest in sorghum because there's no money to be made in sorghum, or in rice, which they can't easily patent. So basically, other groups have now gotten involved. And Gates Foundation, for instance, is funding a lot of projects that are supposedly in the public interest. And actually, my next project is to kind of look at this new quote-unquote green revolution for Africa, and to see what these public groups and foundations, and some of the companies are involved too, are doing, and how they're going to really try to meet the public's interest as opposed to providing crops for first world farmers that save on their labor costs and solve their pest problems, as opposed to, that was a long answer, wasn't it? As opposed to crops for the third world. So, yeah.
Do you talk at all in the book about like, to difference scientifically between, I don't know how to say this, like, proving something is okay versus proving it's safe. Like, the burden should be on Monsanto and others to prove it's safe versus the burden be on others to prove it's unsafe.
Well, that's not how U.S. regulation works. Actually, that's how the European regulations essentially work, because they operate on a precautionary principle. And in the U.S., I talk about it a bit. I don't think I take it on quite that directly. But there, yes, I mean, we do talk a bit about the precautionary principle.
I mean, is that something that could be changed in law, or is it like this?
I think it'd be very difficult to get that into U.S. law. I mean, we have a really different cultural context here, but not only cultural, but political context, in which, I mean, you have to look at the moment too, right? This is a moment where our economy, we have not been the leading industrialized economy, or we're losing ground as the leading industrialized economy. The information technology sectors, the biotech sectors, you know, all these kind of, these kinds of sectors are seen as the cutting edge and the hope for U.S. capitalism. And so there's no way at this particular moment, especially after today, that anything that's going to get in the way of this kind of business development is going to happen in the U.S. because the political space for it is not open. In your, even if consumer sentiments are changing, and I think they really are, it's been fascinating because I think if the activists had been organizing now, in terms of people's awareness of a lot of the problems with the industrial food supply, they would have gotten much more support. You know, after Michael Pollan came out with his book, and after Eric Schlosser wrote Fast Food Nation, and after all these films have come out, and I would say that this is and all this E. coli, all these E. coli problems, and now the problems with antibiotics in the food supply, and you know, I think if the organizing had happened at this moment, there would have been more consumer response. That could have put a bit of pressure on, but I still think on the political end, the moment isn't, there's no open moment. So, and Europe was operating in a moment that was more open. You had just had mad cow disease in Europe, and there were all these worries. There was a Coke debacle, Coca-Cola debacle. There was dioxin and feed in Europe around the time these folks were organizing. And they were able to ride on this increased sensibility and worry about the food supply to get the population to say, wait a minute, we don't want to eat this stuff. You know, it might be safe, but we're ready to slow down and find out if it's safe before we're going to eat it. So... another long-winded answer. Sorry. Yeah.
Do you find that the public in America doesn't feel the same way that the public in Europe does, or just those ideas don't work their way up through the political system? Because it seems that that's what you're saying.
I think both. I think both are true. I think the political system works very differently. There's a parliamentary system in Europe, and the way the EU is structured. I go into a lot of detail into the book about this, but one of the things, the activists took two strategies in Europe to shut GMOs out. One of them was that they got the population to be very sensitive to the issue. Then they pressured the supermarkets, and they did this enormously effective campaign against the supermarkets, trying to get at least one or two of them to go GM-free, because they knew if they got a couple of them to say, we'll abandon GM products, the other ones would be more likely to follow suit. And that's exactly what happened in 1998. I forget which company it was. But it was run by a guy who was very very sympathetic to the movement, a CEO, and he agreed to go GMO-free in his supermarket. It wasn't a very large supermarket. It was one of the small competitors. But the sector was so competitive that then the activists pounced on that and said, see, this company is willing to protect our people. They're not going to take a risk with our health. And they put so much pressure on the other supermarkets that the other supermarkets said, okay, we'll follow your suit. And within 21 months, I have a table in the book, like 13 major supermarkets, and we're talking chains, big chains, Safeway, Tesco, Aldi, and others, went GM-free. So then it couldn't be sold in the supermarkets. That was one strategy. Another strategy was to work through the political system. And it's a very complicated arrangement, but basically there were some Greens who had seats in the EU, and they were, the German Greens in particular, were very effective in kind of pushing the EU to have a moratorium on new crop approvals. So in a, I forget what year, I think it was 1999 or 2000, they got a de facto moratorium in place, and no more crops were able to get through the system because the activists were so effective in pressuring their representatives in the EU to put into place a precautionary policy. They were really strategic. It turned out that one of the Greens was a Greenpeace activist. One of the members of the EU was a Greenpeace activist, and he was one of the most instrumental figures in doing this. So they happened to have a few key people in a few key places, and they were able to manipulate the system in an unbelievable way. And that has to do with political structure. So
that just raises another question for me, if you don't mind. The way that you're describing it seems to, and maybe it's a wrong read on it, seems to imply that they exerted leverage beyond what the public opinion was. And perhaps the reverse is true over here, but I was wondering about the...
Actually, that's a good point. I didn't mean to say a few people manipulated the system and nobody else was behind them, because in fact there were quite a lot of people behind them, and I have data in here. I'm just going to see if I can quickly find it to show you what happened to public opinion in Europe. Over the period from 1996 to 1999, public opinion, veered radically from being actually in lukewarm support of biotech to being deeply opposed to it, and it varied by country. And I have a table. I think I can read you. Okay, here it is. So this is a huge survey, the Eurobarometer surveys they do every year, and it's of all the European countries. It's fairly large N number of observations. So this is the percentage of the population opposed by country between 1996 and 99. I'll just talk about some of the more radical changes. Greece, 51% were opposed in 1996, 81% were opposed in 1999. France, 46% opposed in 96, 65% in 99. Germany, 44% opposed in 96, 51% in 99. Britain, 33% were opposed in 96, meaning two-thirds of the population were okay with it in 96. In 1999, over half are opposed. So there were huge, and other countries too, show these huge swings. So the activists had the public behind them, and that's why the European Union responded, not just because a couple of these guys were managing to affect the system, but they had public support behind them. So... And here, the public has been really quiet about it. There was another really big difference between Europe and the U.S., which was that the activists very luckily were able to pressure the government for labels. And they went, they worked really hard on this issue and said, okay, if you're going to put GM ingredients in our food, the public has a right to know. And this is a moment where the food supply is thrown into question anyway because of mad cow disease and other scares. And the public is totally behind this, saying, of course we have a right to know. How dare you even think of not labeling it? Once it's labeled, then we'll choose. And once it was labeled, then the activists were able to motivate people not to buy it. And here in the U.S., the industry recognized that this could happen, and it fought tooth and nail around this labeling issue and made absolutely sure that the activists would not win on the labeling struggle. And there was the same labeling struggle here, and the industry threw millions and millions of dollars into both local struggles, like there was a referendum in Oregon, to a local labeling referendum, and they spent $6 million or something in this in Eugene, Oregon, and 2001 or 2002 to defeat a labeling effort, because they knew that as soon as it could be labeled, it was quite possible that the activists could tell people, if it says GMO, don't buy it. So that was you know, a big difference in terms of why the activists were able to be so effective in Europe. Yeah.
Is there an effort to monopolize the seed by these GMO people, or by these technology people? Are they out to actually, I mean, so people can't grow things? I mean, I think it would be impossible to enforce it and so forth, but I mean, is there an effort to do that? Is that, that's the specter that hangs over the thing?
Yeah. Well, they've made an effort to enforce it, actually. Monsanto, at least for a number of years, not that long, you know, in the last 4 years, 5 years, has prosecuted a lot of cases against U.S. farmers who were not paying technology fees, who were replanting seeds that had their technology in them. And they prosecuted that guy, Percy Schmeiser, that Canadian farmer. And he, you know, he's a big part of the anti-biotech movement. So, yes, they try to enforce it. Are they trying to monopolize seeds? I'd say they're trying to capture the largest market share that they can. They would not ever say they were trying to monopolize it, but of course they want to increase the number of bags of GM seed they sell. So in that sense, they have a strong drive and incentive to try to increase their sales. They can't enforce a monopoly because farmers, of course, can say, I'm not going to use it. In fact, right now, they've stacked all these traits. They have like a stacked GM seed with, you know, six different traits, and it's become so expensive for farmers that a bunch of farmers are not buying it. And so it's not that particular seed investment hasn't worked out that well for them. So they can't, of course, enforce a monopoly. But what they have done is crowded other seeds out of the market. And that's a real concern. In fact, sugar beets is an interesting case because I don't know if anybody's paid any attention to this, but they created a genetically modified sugar beet about 3 years ago. It entered the market, and within about 2 years, 90% of the sugar beets in the U.S. Had become genetically modified. Well, one of these activist groups that I write a lot about in here, Center for Food Safety, they've been at this struggle for 25 years, and they keep bringing up these cases against the government for not adequately testing environmental impacts, not doing their environmental impacts assessments correctly, or doing them at all. And so they were able to get an injunction against genetically modified sugar beets a few months ago. And now the sugar beet industry is in a complete mess because all the other seeds are gone and the farmers have gotten rid of half of the technology that they use, and they can't even get non-GM seeds. So it is a problem. You know, I don't think of them quite as nefariously as the activists do, because I feel like they're just doing what businesses do. And that's what we have to be aware of. You know, they're not, well, if you read some of Monsanto's literature, it does sound like they are trying to take over the world seed supply. I mean, I have incredible quotes in this book that are in their annual reports about how, you know, to stay competitive in the industry, they've bought up hundreds of seed companies. I mean, they are the dominant owner now, Monsanto is, of, you know, the largest seed supply in the world.
Well, wow. Just to follow that up, it seems like legally we shouldn't allow this. We shouldn't allow them to prosecute. In other words, if someone else gets your seed that you worked on, fine, let them have. I mean, they're going to say, oh, well, we invented it and so forth. But this is seed. That people use and can be blown all over the place. And how are they going to enforce it? How are they going to keep track and police whose seed is what? It's ridiculous. Why should you allow that? Allow them to prosecute? If you go ahead and invent a seed, you take the risk that someone else is going to grow with it.
Well, that's why they have patents. I mean, they basically, they establish, they do it through two different routes. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying this is what they do. They try to protect their intellectual property because that's their investment. And that's, you know, that's where I agree with the activists. I think it's highly problematic that this is all privatized.
Patent shouldn't cover this.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's fascinating because I don't know if any of you paid attention to the news in the last week, but on Friday, the Obama administration, I wish I had the exact details of this, came out and is one of the higher courts, not the Supreme Court, but one of the higher courts came out in opposition to the patenting of human genes. And, you know, there's this, been this dispute about breast cancer genes and being able to test women for breast cancer. And the patent office, since 1980, and then again in 1985, there were key decisions that pushed the country in the direction of more and more patenting. More and more things were allowed to be patented that have to do with genes, gene sequences, and so on. And human genes were included in that. And so there's been this incredible gene rush, gold rush, but for genes and gene patents. And just this week, the U.S. government is trying, you know, has voiced a bit of opposition to the human gene patenting. And then today in the paper, there are all these biotech lawyers or lawyers for these companies that are saying, you know, the government's effort to stop this is just plain dumb. They literally said just plain dumb about three times in the New York Times today. So they're going to really fight this because these gene patents are their bread and butter. It's what makes them money on Wall Street. It's what, you know, raises their stock values. And they've got a lot invested in this, and they have a lot of lawyers. I mean, one of the things I learned from studying this industry is half of it's made up of lawyers. They're not even, it's not scientists or corporate managers who are, you know, the key actors here, but they just employ an army of lawyers. And Monsanto is the worst of the bunch. It employs lawyers all over the world to influence all the regulatory systems around its technology. It's really pretty amazing.
I was just going to comment that lest we think this is just a U.S. problem, that case in Canada, the Percy
Schmeiser
case,
yeah.
The Canadian Supreme Court ruled against it.
Right, I know.
So it's not just our legal system.
Okay, I'll take two more questions, then I'll stop because I can see people look like they have to leave, and anybody who wants to stay can. Yeah.
So I know you mentioned this earlier, but talking about, like, with all the new food revolution happening now, with Food Inc., with, you know, all those
popular books.
And I know it's gaining ground. I know it can't happen in the next, 10 years, but do you think within the next 50 years, you suppose, there's going to be enough public support to just end the system? Because there's...
I think the system will evolve over time. There won't be an end to any system, but what'll happen is, and it's already happening, the organic sector's growing, the local food movement's growing, the sustainable ag movement's growing, people are becoming more conscious. Actually, about 2 or 3 years ago, all these major supermarkets told their milk suppliers that they no longer wanted them to supply milk made with bovine growth hormone. Well, activists in Wisconsin, where I was in graduate school at the time, including some of my friends, were really involved in 1989 trying to stop BGH, bovine growth hormone, from being developed by Monsanto and used, and they lost that battle. But now, 20 years later, supermarkets are telling their dairies they want them to stop using this hormone. So there's definitely cultural and market change going on, and I think that's what'll happen. My guess is the government won't step in and regulate very much, although it might regulate around the antibiotic stuff. I think also companies will become increasingly sensitive. Food companies are becoming increasingly sensitive to consumer trends and these cultural shifts, and they're starting to go slowly in that direction, but without losing too much on the investments they've made. Companies that are involved in the biotech sector are not going to move because that's all they've got. So they're not going to change. So I think there'll be change. I don't think it'll come top down. I think it'll sort of come from a lot of different directions. Lisa, did you have a question?
Yeah, kind of related to what you just said about companies maybe making some changes, but in your interviewing people in industry, did you see any change over time from them being so excited in the beginning to seeing what's going on now?
I
talked to a lot of former employees.
Yeah, I interviewed in a period of about 3 years, and it was sort of... The sense of excitement that I was able to glean from this was interviewing people about their early years. I didn't interview them in 1982 and then again in 2002. I interviewed them in 2002 about their whole experience.
Did they talk about changing their attitudes about what was happening, though?
They had gotten much more sensitive to the threat posed by the activists. And you know, as a result, had gotten, they were forced to try to deal with it. And they did, and the industry did. It has spent a lot of money trying to influence public opinion, both here and in Europe. I don't know if that answers the question. So
I guess my question is, did their, what did you call it, the
life worlds?
Yeah,
did their life world
change?
I don't think so. I don't think they were convinced at all by what the activists were saying, because I think they, you know, most of the people in the industry really believe in what they're doing. They don't feel like they're doing something wrong, and the ones who did got out. In fact, some people who were activists had been in the industry and early on and then had a total change of heart, not very many. I did not have many activists who'd worked in the industry, but there are a few. And they just... They were scientists who'd gone in and been excited about some of this stuff and then gotten out. Most of them were bench scientists. So I wouldn't say there's much shift in the industry. The industry had to change its tune a bit. It had to act like it was, and had to become concerned with public opinion because it was getting kicked in the knees. And they started bringing in activists to do focus groups. And whatnot, into St. Louis, where Monsanto's headquarters are, because, I mean, they felt like they were just blindsided by this, you know, what was going on. And so they did try to understand, but I think they tried to understand cognitively. I don't think they ever could really understand the moral passion that was driving the activists, and the sense that, I mean, some people just feel like this is wrong to monkey around with nature this way. And so that they never were able to really understand that. They saw that as a belief system. And the activists saw them as having a belief system. It was just a different belief system. So anyway, I'm happy to stay and talk to anybody who wants to, but maybe we should end the formal part. If people are interested in the book, they're welcome to get it, and I'm happy to sign it and entertain more questions or just chat. Thanks for all of you for coming.